I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Standing next to a little boy whose mother died after she lost her health insurance, and with Democratic lawmakers snapping pictures on cell phones, President Obama took a victory lap today, signing into law historic health care reform that within months will stop insurers from dropping people because they're sick and help seniors pay for prescription drugs.
We are a nation that faces its challenges and accepts its responsibilities. We are a nation that does what is hard, what is necessary, what is right. Here in this country, we shape our own destiny. That is what we do. That is who we are. That is what makes us the United States of America. And we have now just enshrined, as soon as I sign this bill, the core principle that everybody should have some basic security when it comes to their health care.
Obama then took up pens and made the bill law. But Republicans are girding for battle. The Republican National Committee released this web ad today.
2.5 million jobs have been lost in the year since Obama and Pelosi started trying to ram through their health care takeover. It's time to focus on jobs and cutting government spending. It's time to fire Nancy Pelosi. Now that's a cause worth celebrating.
The image at the end of the ad, Nancy Pelosi going up in flames, evoking another image of Republican Congressman Steve King of Iowa slapping Pelosi's face on a poster in Congress over the weekend. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He's author of ABC's political blog, The Note. So, Rick, a lot of positive, forward-thinking feeling at the signing. Where do Republicans go now?
Repeal is the mantra of the day. It's just passed, but they're saying they want to undo it, and that's the clean message that they're trying to offer to the American people. They've also got some procedural wrangling that's going to be going on in the Senate this week, and then there's a raft of lawsuits and legislative maneuvering in the states that challenge the constitutionality, the legality of various aspects of the bill. So they're keeping the fight alive. They think this is a fight that, as long as it's center stage, is a good one for them. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, they have lost this battle. They lost the battle legislatively. We haven't seen them really recalibrate the strategy. They're still running against this bill as if it hadn't passed.
But have they perhaps lost more than the battle, and is it all Republicans who feel this way? You have these images that are piling up, Tea Party protesters tormenting a man with Parkinson's a few weeks ago, over the weekend spitting at congressmen, Republican Congressman Randy Neugebauer of Texas now admitting he was the one who yelled out baby killer on the floor of the House. He says his words were directed at the health bill, not at Congressman Bart Stupak. But you have conservative David Frum seeming to react to all of this by saying that the party has now sowed doubts with the public about its ideas and leadership credentials.
Yeah, David Frum is so far in the vast minority, but he is speaking, I think, to a quiet frustration about a failure to articulate a bigger message around this, that, yes, the Republicans have lost this pretty major war over health care. The point that David Frum makes and others is that you have a situation here where this is going to be the law of the land. And once the Senate finishes its work on it this week, this is going to be the structure. There is no chance, realistically, of repealing this. And maybe there's some short-term political gains for Republicans, but those are short-term political gains. Those are things that you can give back easily. Seats in Congress shift both ways. Meanwhile, you're going to have this major restructuring of a sixth of the American economy in place, and the Republicans really bystanders in that process.
Well, Frum says conservative talkers on Fox and radio are to blame for whipping Republicans into such a frenzy that deal-making was impossible. They weren't part of the process. But he also says that the Republican base is going to be less energized when they discover that this thing isn't as catastrophic as advertised. What's the talk in Washington? Because the bill is front-loaded so that very popular things come out first.
That's right. And the hope among Democrats is that you'll see these positive things go into effect and people will have real changes in their lives. And meanwhile, the awful things like grandma being unplugged aren't going to happen. Death panels won't be in place. And once that happens, then Democrats have a cleaner message that they can present to the public around all of this. There's a lot of optimism that once people, and there's concrete stories of people obtaining health care that couldn't get it before, people who, you know, been mistreated by the system in the past, that gives the Democrats a chance to sell this. They've lost so much of the message battle. They've lost so much ground in terms of the framing of this to Republicans. They're eager for a chance to talk about something proactively and positively.
Well, and what about going forward, using what Democrats see as momentum to push through other items on the agenda? What's the talk there?
there's a lot of hope that they can use this framework and this new sense of possibility that for Democrats to push major immigration, energy legislation, economic growth, financial regulatory reform. The problem is they're going to come up against the exact same math and a really even more embittered Republican Party along the way. Republicans have no incentive to play with President Obama. There's less incentive maybe now than ever before because they feel so wronged by this health care process. So it's just hard to imagine vast legislation passing. You really can only get Congress to swallow so much at any given time. At this point, we're pretty deep into the election cycle, even though it's only March, and it's hard to imagine the big things happening again.
Former presidential candidate John McCain is one who's said, we're not going to be on board on anything going forward, sort of implying that because we're angry about health care, but then we flip back. Does that not position the Republicans again as, you know, allowing their bruised feelings to not go forward on anything?
It does very much, and David Axelrod kind of had a snippy response saying, look, that's something you say on the schoolyard. You're taking your ball and you're going home now. But it is really the prevailing view among Republicans. There's a lot of anger out there and a feeling that they've got the American people on their side and that there's a kind of big gamble going on both sides about who is really speaking to the true voice of the American people. And really, there's only one way to sort that out, and it doesn't involve legislating. It involves voting in the fall.
Well, meanwhile, we have this package of fixes to health care reform. It includes a reform of student loans. We'll have more on that later in the program. It's up for a vote in the Senate this week. What's the sense of whether or not it will pass?
Well, there's a lot of maneuvering that's going to happen. There's going to be a couple of uncomfortable votes potentially. There's some chance that they have to go back to the House because of some changes in all of this. But at this point, it's going to happen by the weekend. Lawmakers have a two-week recess around Easter. They really want to get out of town for that. And at this point, there's a sense of resignation around the whole health care issue. The Democrats clearly have the votes. They clearly have the process on their side. They have the momentum. It's going to happen.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABC's political blog, The Note, and co-host of the political webcast Top Line. Rick, thanks as always for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, many of you might remember our conversation with pioneer CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth, a New Zealand native who covered violent conflicts in the Middle East, Georgia, and Bosnia. When we spoke in October, she was living in a hospice in Minnesota, waging a battle against colon cancer. It was a difficult conversation. Margaret lost the lower part of her jaw and her ability to speak clearly to sniper fire in Sarajevo in 1992. She returned to work for CNN after that devastating attack. She returned to Sarajevo and from there went on to other battle zones. But her speech wasn't the difficulty. Her impending death was. This past weekend, Margaret died at the age of 59. So today, we want to revisit this extraordinary life. We were introduced to Margaret Moth by her former colleague, now our colleague here at WBUR in Boston, Steph Katsonis. Steph was in the car with Margaret when she was shot in Sarajevo. They're both featured in a new CNN documentary about Margaret. It's called Fearless, The Margaret Moth Story. And I began by asking her, was she really fearless?
I don't know whether I would think of it like that. I don't think I'm fearless. That would be an unhealthy way to be.
You don't think you're fearless. That would not be good.
I could tell you stories of times when my legs have literally shaken.
You have the stories of the legs shaking, and I'm sure much worse in war zones. And, Steph, that would be... As you have also been a longtime war correspondent, that would be the smart approach to covering a war.
To be afraid.
Yes.
Yes, be afraid, be very afraid, but be calm.
Well, Steph, we know that Margaret, and maybe thankfully, doesn't remember anything of the day that she was shot by snipers in Sarajevo, but you, sitting next to her in the car, remember everything. Can you just give us a sense of, you know, what happened, what that day was like?
Well, I mean... it's just awful. The thing was to get her to the hospital. I knew it was bad, and then it started. Your eyes kind of slowly start understanding what's going on, particularly since once we got into the car, what she was holding together all fell apart. And I don't even want to describe to you what I was staring at. We're very lucky that the hospital hadn't had a big bombing that day. It could have been a swamped emergency room. In fact, it was nearly empty.
You've described for us in a horrible scene. You know, Margaret's teeth in your clothing. And we're looking at pictures, by the way, Margaret. You're a beautiful woman even after the shooting. Stunning before, big bright blue eyes with, doesn't matter what war zone you're in, you always had the black eyeliner on, sort of a Chrissy Hynde, character, only more beautiful in the war zone. Steph, what's your sense of Margaret, she is legendary. What did it mean to you to have her as a camerawoman?
Well, I mean, I hate to start with the more lighthearted, but that was an important part of it. These are high-pressure situations. You work with a lot of different people, a lot of different crews. You're all rotating in and out. And in these really stressful times, you have to be able to work together, because a decision to cross a bridge into a village where there's gunfire or not to, your team has to agree. As Margaret has said in the past, you don't go in thinking with a death wish, thinking you're going to get killed. You go in calculating that you can survive.
Right. And Margaret, in the film, we hear from many people who worked with you, Christiane Amanpour, the list is long, including a sound man who talks about, you know, he was umbilically attached to you through his cord and he had to go where you went. Let's listen.
I remember being with Margaret on Sniper Alley in Bosnia and Sarajevo, and Margaret would like run between the buildings and I was attached on a cable to her doing sound. So when she ran, you had to run. So I had to kind of like just be ready to go when she was ready to go. And sometimes I wasn't. You'd feel the cable like tug and you'd realize that you're running out into view of the sniper whether you liked it or not.
What was your thinking, Margaret, in filming? You said it wasn't that you were fearless, but you seemed to be. You were out in front.
Just what I need to do to get what I need and how best to go about it and remain as safe as you can be.
What to do to get what you need? It seemed to be, in many cases, just standing in one place as chaos broke out around you.
Yes, I'm a great believer in not making any sudden moves. I've seen the folly of that too often. And especially if you're carrying the camera and you run, often it looks like you have something on your shoulder. I stay very still.
And if you run, someone might think you have a rocket launcher or something.
Yes.
To the extent that we see in the film footage of yours taken of government gunmen in Georgia who are attacking a crowd walking right by you. Steph Katsonis, I think you were there in Georgia, am I wrong?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You tell a story about seasoned cameramen responding to what Margaret did.
Well, the funny thing was we were filming the demonstration as it was unfolding, and I, with my impeccable sense of what's about to come down the road, left. Before the gunman opened fire. About, I don't remember now, let's say it was an hour later, half an hour later, all the reporters, all the camera people started rushing back into the hotel that we were all camped out in. And one of the, I think it was a British cameraman, said to me, "Your Margaret's amazing." And I said, "What? Why? What?" And the guy said to me, he said, "When these gunmen opened fire on the crowds, we did the obvious thing of scurrying and hiding behind the cars. And we were hunched down behind the cars, not getting the pictures." And this guy suddenly realized there was a shadow being cast over his arms and his camera. And he sort of was confused. He looks up into the sky and silhouetted against the light, the sunlight, is Margaret standing there tall and strong out in front of the cars, right in the middle of, just off to the side of the line of fire, filming these guys as they strode forth looking like, you know, so many thugs, marching into the crowd of innocent people and firing at them.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with legendary CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth, who died of cancer this past weekend at 59. In 1992, Margaret was shot in the face by a sniper in Sarajevo and did not put her camera down. After many surgeries and with her speech impaired, she went back to cover wars. But cancer finally made her lower her lens. And last fall, Margaret was the subject of a CNN documentary titled Fearless, The Margaret Moth Story. We spoke with her when it first came out, joined by our colleague Steph Katsonis, a former CNN reporter who was with Margaret when she was shot. One of the qualities that comes up over and over again in the documentary is Margaret's independent spirit. We played her this clip of her colleague Hala Gurani.
She does not give a toss what anybody thinks about her. She has absolutely her own unique set of values of what she thinks is important in life. She doesn't care about the establishment, the whole what is expected of women. I mean, she's a true pioneer.
Correspondent Hala Gorani speaking about camerawoman Margaret Moth. And Margaret, that clip reminds us of a story about UN staff in Baghdad just after the Gulf War. Women are not allowed to walk the streets, so you were told by your Iraqi handler to stay in the car. But Steph sees a story in a market. You get out and you go to take a still photograph. When a policeman slaps the camera away and hits your face, and you do what?
Now, my natural reaction was to hit back, and his cigarette went flying in the air.
This is one of Saddam Hussein's
secret policemen,
and you smack him across the face.
No, well, the way I saw it, it was she starts to take a picture, and then in moments behind us, fruit stalls, vendor stalls are tumbling over. The riot is catching fire. It's like watching gasoline go up in fire. She stood up, and you may not remember this, Margaret, but I remember your words. You slapped him and said, "Don't you ever," and slapped me in the face or something like that. And his cigarette flew, and you could hear a collective intake of air. You know, 500,000 citizens of Saddam City and the CNN correspondent almost suffocated with fear when we saw her hit a secret policeman. And then the guy made believe he was going to arrest me and drag me away from the crowd. I think just to save face.
That was funny. We had a lot of laughs there.
Yes, you did. Yeah. Yes, you did. Margaret, what was it about for you? The film tells your life story. The first female photographer in New Zealand, was it?
Yes. As in Australia and New Zealand.
An avid skydiver. In fact, you took your name, Moth, from a Tiger Moth plane that you used to like to fly in. So always obviously an adventurer. But was it about adventure to be a war correspondent, a camera person? Or was it about wanting to make sure those pictures got out?
I think it was curiosity as much as anything. Wars and conflicts often tend to be the turning points in history. And I think a lot of it was wanting to be there, to know what was really going on, to try and capture that on tape.
So the curiosity, a love of history, and an attempt to try to bring it back somehow for people. Steph, you remind us, too, always, that a camera person has one blind side.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's even more dangerous than we think.
Any situation like that, you look left and right and up and down and everywhere to stay alert and to stay safe. And the thing that has always amazed me is the discipline of Margaret and camera people like her to allow themselves not to look over their right shoulder, because they've always got blocking their view on that right shoulder a big black box of electronics. And they just have to trust the people who are with them, who are maybe grabbing them by the belt to pull them back or whispering in their other ear quietly to keep them alive. I mean, literally.
Do you think it made a difference?
Well, one would hope so, to inspire more interest and curiosity. But whether you succeed or not, I don't know.
Well, Margaret, and now, of course, the irony abounds. You know, you survive things that should be unsurvivable and are now struggling with a very aggressive cancer. In fact, we're speaking to you at a hospice in Minnesota. But, you know, you seem so accepting.
Well, I feel we all die, and I just feel in some ways it's irrelevant as to when you die, since you're going to die anyway. And I think it's more important how you live your life. I strive to get as much out of every day, every hour that I'm alive. Yeah. And I've never had a fear of dying, and I hope I can die with as much dignity as I've lived.
Can I tell a story about something Margaret told me not so long ago that pertains?
Please.
Margaret came over to visit a couple of months ago, get away for a weekend on the Cape with our good friend and her best friend, Joe. And we hadn't seen each other face-to-face for some years. And I was lamenting a little bit the passage of time, how time had caught up on me and how I would look in the mirror and was shocked to see an older fellow standing there staring back at me. And Margaret, who meanwhile is facing far greater challenges than looking in the mirror, said to me, "Wait a minute, Steph. You know, you read a book and you're on chapter 9. Who the hell wants to go back to chapter 6? You want to keep on reading to the last chapter, don't you? Why look back? What do you care?" And I've got to say, Margaret, that has not left me, that thought.
to me, it's just another adventure. It's the next chapter. Okay, yes, it may be the final chapter, but that's irrelevant. It's like, it's just another adventure in life. It's just another experience.
A lot of people have very wonderful sort of awakenings in their final days, or when they come to realize that they're going to die, and they inspire others in the way they confront it. Margaret didn't come to an awakening. This is simply a continuation. She's been awake the whole time.
Our friend Stefano Katsonis and his friend and former colleague, legendary CNN camerawoman Margaret Moth, speaking last October. Margaret died this past Saturday at the age of 59 at the Minnesota hospice that had been her home for nearly a year. So glad we had that conversation. Still ahead today, new perils for the women of Haiti. But the latest news is next, here and now. Somewhat lost in the hoopla over health care reform was an amendment House lawmakers tacked onto the reconciliation bill Sunday night that cuts the middleman out of the government-backed student loan program. The measure would no longer allow banks to initiate federally backed student loans and reap fees for doing so. Instead, the government will make those loans directly to students. That could save $60 billion over 10 years, and much of the savings would go toward helping low-income students pay for college with Pell Grants. But there are critics. Daniel DeVise is education reporter for The Washington Post. Daniel, the government already makes loans directly to students. Now Congress is proposing that the government make all of these loans. But does that mean that all private lenders like Sallie Mae would be cut out of the government-backed loan business?
That's right. The private lenders, if this bill became law, would no longer be able to make loans to students backed by the government, but they could still service them. They could still be the ones calling you on the phone and saying, give us the payment.
Right.
So there'd still be a huge number of jobs in this sector, but it would be the private companies basically servicing the loans issued by the government.
Well, and in part because in 2007, the private lending industry came under a lot of criticism. It was discovered many were overcharging the government, offering colleges incentives to send students their way. But banks and many Republicans are against this amendment, this change.
Well, it's curious because the sector is not healthy. It's been shrinking because I guess these loans, these subsidized loans, are not very palatable to banks right now. So the industry was actually starting to shrink. But once it came under threat of elimination, yes, the industry rallied in defense of this sector. And the arguments have been several. I think the chief one is that possibly tens of thousands of jobs in private lending would be lost. Now, there's a counter to this from the people who are in support of the legislation say that it's true that some jobs creating loans in private banks would be lost, but a whole bunch of other jobs would be created, again, in the servicing of the loans. And there's another really important piece here, which is that direct federal loans can only be serviced by Americans, apparently. In other words, if you're an employee from a bank hitting me up for my loan payment, you have to be an American. So it would actually end some outsourcing to, say, India. That couldn't be done anymore.
Interesting. Well, still you have Senator Ben Nelson, the Democrat from Nebraska, who says he's going to vote against reconciliation in part because it strips out his so-called Cornhusker kickback that would give extra Medicaid money to Nebraska, but also because of the student loan provision. He's one who says it's going to jeopardize some 30,000 jobs. You're explaining that, in fact, some jobs might be kept. But what is the sense of how likely this amendment is to pass?
I just talked to people in Congress. Apparently, it's very likely to pass. Don't get me wrong. Sallie Mae and the other private lenders will continue to rally strenuously against this measure, but apparently it's not likely they will prevail.
Well, another side effect, we understand it will be a salvation for the Pell Grant program. This is the government program that gives grants, not loans, to low-income students. It was foundering. A lot of this money is going to go to those grants?
Well, correct. That was always the idea here, was to take all the savings, $60 billion in savings. It was originally almost $90 billion, but the amount shrank, and then pump that into the Pell program. Pell was created in the 70s. It's this enormous federal grant program to basically send low-income kids to college, and it's in very bad shape right now because the economy is so bad. There's just a huge demand for Pell grants. I think it's about $20 billion in the red right now. And the effect of that would be that many kids would be either cut from the program, would get less aid, or would simply end up dropping out of school because they can no longer afford to attend. And this is if this bill does not become law. This is the worst fear. And so of the $60 billion, a good portion of it will go to simply closing the shortfall in Pell, and then a lot of the rest of it will go toward just very gradually increasing the maximum Pell grant from about $5,500 to around $6,000 over the next 10 years. So it'll be a more consistent and sort of reliable source of grant aid to lower-income students, where in the past, Pell was pretty shaky. It would kind of go up, it would go down. The idea now is to have it consistent from year to year.
Going forward, what can students expect?
One change that would happen if this bill became law is that students could count on having to pay no more than 10% of their income towards student loan payments every month. And the idea is that people who don't earn very much money right out of the gate would not be drowning in student loan debt.
So that's going to sound good for students. Daniel DeVise, education reporter for The Washington Post, talking about proposed changes in the student loan industry tied to the reconciliation bill. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, take a break when we come back. A difficult topic, rape in Haiti. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Nearly 700,000 Haitians are living in makeshift tented communities. The tents provide some shelter, some sense of privacy, but no security. And as our next guest found, life in these tented communities is extremely dangerous for girls and women. Suzanne Song is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist on a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at Stanford's Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. She's been with us before to talk about her work in Africa. She's just back from Haiti and alerted us to the problem of rape there. It's a difficult topic to listen to at times. Suzanne joins us from a studio in Stanford. Suzanne, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you were in Haiti as part of a medical legal team from the U.S. Interviewing Haitians for humanitarian parole. This allows people otherwise inadmissible to come to the U.S. on a temporary basis if they have a compelling need. And so you knew these applicants were in need, but still, what was your sense of what you saw?
Well, you know, there was a story of Haiti that we've all heard. This is kind of the first wave of tragedy of the earthquake and all of the personal losses. When I was walking around Port-au-Prince, you know, there's rubble everywhere. There's cement roofs of buildings that are teetering, about to crumble. And there's this smell of dead bodies just lingering in the air. Mm. The sidewalks and parks are full of tents or tarps or sheets that pretend to organize some sort of privacy. But there's little access to food, clean water. There's nowhere to bathe. There's barely access to health care, let alone mental health care. And there are so many children and young people just wandering the streets who have lost their entire family. So that, though, I kind of expected. What I was shocked to see, though, was a story on top of that, which was this kind of second wave of tragedy that I saw, where women are being targeted and raped. Almost 80% of the people that I saw were raped. You know, anywhere from 2 years old to 72 years old.
2 to 72?
2 years old, yes.
Well, explain these tent communities. No lighting. Tell us a little bit about how they feel.
These people are, you know, the weakest, most vulnerable part of society. They have no support, no shelter, no security. You hear of people that complain about women screaming at night when they're being raped. I spoke to so many women who are so violated, and they're really in survival mode. So, for example, there's a 16-year-old girl that really touched me. She lost her entire family in the earthquake, like most of the people that I spoke to. So she wandered the streets in the days afterwards. She was taken in by a woman on the street. But after 2 months, the husband in that tent had said, you know, I give you food, I give you shelter, you need to give me sex. The 16-year-old girl refused. The woman kicked her out, and she was again homeless. So she continues to walk down the street, and she was approached by this elder man. And he said, you know, what are you doing alone, wandering the streets? There are bad men out there who will do bad things to young girls. Come and stay with me and my wife. So she thought he's an older man. He's got a woman there, and she has nowhere else to go. So she follows him to his home. She sleeps for a couple of hours, and then he returns with two men. And so all three of them took turns raping, choking, hitting her. And somehow, the 16-year-old girl managed to run out of that house. And thankfully, a woman brought her in, cleaned her with vinegar, gave her some herbal medicine in case she was pregnant. But this is a very common story that I heard.
Well, your area is post-conflict work. And you've seen some terrible things, but we're hearing that in Haiti, one of the problems, we did a story on how the prisons were destroyed, prisoners emptied out into these camps. Many of them are still there. Who was doing the raping?
What I've heard is that you're right in that the prison had collapsed, so many prisoners were released, and a lot of them were former opposition to Aristide.
This was the democratically elected former president. Aristide was ousted twice, and in both cases, opposition members, after he was ousted, used rape as a power tool.
Right. For example, this elder man who raped this young girl, I wonder if he was part of the political opposition and he was a prisoner who was then released.
Well, the AP reports that one of the problems is that many of the police were either killed or are homeless. The UN has finally set up some patrols in these tent cities. But did you see evidence of police or patrols trying to at least protect some of the people?
You know, I saw no police. I did see UN trucks driving by, but I didn't see anybody actually within the tent communities where I think a lot of the sexual assault is taking place.
Well, we understand, too, there's a group, COFAVIV, K-O-F-A-V-I-V, an acronym for a group of Haitian women who themselves survived political rapes, and now they help other women. Their office was destroyed. They're operating from a tent. So are Haitians starting to respond to the rapes?
Yes, this group is amazing. It's an outstanding group. I'm so impressed by the women that I spoke to there. One of the women actually said that she was raped in 1991, she was raped in 2004, and now in 2010 she feels like she's being raped again with this earthquake. I mean, the women of COFAVIV, lots of them were pro-Aristide, pro-democracy, and they'd experienced political sexual violence in the past. And now, with this additional trauma of the earthquake, they're re-experiencing their past 10 times more. But it's such a nice group because they actually have psychosocial support, and they have these peer counseling where women really find strength with each other, and they take care of each other.
Well, Suzanne, as we said, you know, your expertise is mental health. And we also talked about how it's dangerous to impose Western thinking about mental health on other countries. Mm-hmm. But what do you think needs to happen? You've got people in shock because of an earthquake, and then we know the trauma that comes from rape. So what needs to happen for them?
I don't think there's one solution, but the definite areas where people could be helped would include provisions of basic needs, and along with that, security for the most vulnerable. Also to monitor food and aid distribution. So those are the basic needs that, of course, need to be met. But there's this also darker side that's surfacing. And that's where I think psychosocial support is really primary. If we can focus on family reunification, strengthening of supports, and trying to find a way to empower these survivors, you can start by giving them a voice. Because right now, people think they're invisible. People think that no one cares about them. None of the women that I spoke to even thought about telling police. They just don't think police will do anything for them. So it truly feels like anarchy in some way. I mean, they have nowhere to turn to. They have no supports except other peers who have also been survivors of sexual assault.
Suzanne Song, she's just returned from Haiti. She's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist finishing up a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry at Stanford. Suzanne, Dr. Song, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Violin virtuoso David Garrett has landed. If you've tuned into a PBS pledge drive recently, you've probably seen him. Maybe you caught him on Oprah. Why not? It's not often one stumbles across a violin virtuoso who's also modeled for Armani. When we spoke with David last spring, the German-born European sensation was just launching his American invasion. He was trained at Juilliard. He paid for his education through modeling. His CDs have gone gold, and his concert tours sold out in Europe. Now he's touring the U.S. promoting his self-titled CD, traditional fare like Vivaldi, but also some unexpected choices. Yes, AC/DC's Thunderstruck. David also covers Michael Jackson, Metallica, and Bizet's Carmen on his CD, David Garrett. We spoke when it was first released. you know, there's sort of a public relations genre, you know. She paints watercolors and is also a steel worker. He plays the violin and is a model. But you, you know, were a virtuoso. When did you know you could play?
Well, I think every morning I have to prove it to myself. I think that's the most important thing, that you never really get too excited about what you're doing, and you always challenge yourself every morning. So it's an everyday kind of struggle almost,
yeah,
you know, to kind of strive for perfection.
So you're still striving, but we understand you first appeared with the German Symphony. Your dad is German,
yeah.
Your mom American, and you first appeared with the German Symphony at the age of 8?
Exactly. It was my first solo appearance, yeah.
Do you remember what you played?
Sarasate Zigeunerweisen, Gypsy Heiress, which is quite a, I mean, I think I can even play an excerpt of it.
Sure.
It's quite a fast paced piece. That.
So as an 8-year-old, could you play it like that?
I think so. I was pretty good very, very early. I guess my parents made me practice a few hours every day.
Well, then we understand you went to New York without telling your parents. You want to have a normal life. You sort of put aside the violin for a while, maybe some clubbing, some girls. Mm-hmm. And then on a lark, auditioned for Juilliard. What happened?
Well, basically, I pretty much got accepted to study with a wonderful violinist called Itzhak Praumann.
We've heard of him.
And that was, of course, I was more than excited to go to Juilliard School to study there.
What was it like to study with Praumann?
All our conversations which we had were just totally musically related. And, you know, anything to do with how to phrase something, how much bow speed you to actually use. And sound, of course, you know, because every violinist has to kind of develop his own voice, and nobody can teach you that. So I think what he tried to kind of show every of his students, really to kind of dig down deep and find your own voice on the violin.
Well, let's hear a little of yours. We were thinking that one of Perlman's favorite pieces was Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor.
Right. I can play a few notes of that. I told
that?
You to challenge me, so...
play. I'm hearing how, you know, classical composers were the rock stars of their day. Because,
definitely.
Yeah.
What today is Metallica and, you know, like all those big rock groups, you know, the popularity of those groups, you can compare it to like a Beethoven or Mozart.
And you do that. Let's listen to, from the CD, your version of one of Metallica's pieces. Nothing Else Matters by Metallica, played by violinist David Garrett. David, is that how you hear rock music?
It's pretty much the closest to classical music, what I feel, because you have to be quite a good instrumentalist in order to be a good rock musician. You have to have very, very good timing. You have to have a very good technique. So I can relate to rock music a lot.
Yeah. How do you plan on proceeding from here? You are now a rock star in Europe. You sell out stadiums, and you're introducing classical to a lot of people who may not have heard it before. And yet I'm sure, you know, because of your, you know, Itzhak Praumann being your teacher, you went to Juilliard, you don't want to, I'm sure you want to keep the credentials that you have.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I think I love listening to all sorts of music directions. But I think the core of my heart is still classical, and I will never kind of, you know, lose that. About 60 to 70%. Of my concerts this year are core classical, you know, Beethoven Concerto, Elgar, you know, Tchaikovsky. You know, this is really where I'm coming from. And I also want people, you know, through the music I'm doing with, you know, more popular stuff, I really want people also to kind of listen, you know, take a second and listen to the, you know, great classical composers. And people just love it, you know. It's just, you know, packaging it right and, you know, just having, you know, their attention for a second.
Yeah. Well, but you're not a guy who plays Metallica who dabbles in classical. You want to have the respect of the classical community.
It's only natural, I think, if you've worked so many years on becoming a good classical violinist that, you know, of course you don't want to lose that. So even if you, you know, do something like Smooth Criminal, you try to kind of make it technically very difficult, if I may demonstrate.
Please.
Like really try to, you know, also with those pieces, not to kind of cheat yourself, you know.
It's again, Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal from David Garrett. We'd like to hear one last thing.
Sure.
Is it true that your rendition of The Flight of the Bumblebee is going to be in the Guinness Book of World Records?
It is indeed, yeah. I always had a thing for like fast-paced pieces, and I guess I always had a kind of a talent for that. So, yeah, it's true.
How fast?
I got about 14 notes per second in it, so
whoa.
I think a lot.
And can you, we know you're not in training, and so it may not be.
Yeah, sure, I can give you
an
example.
Just a little bit?
You know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a violin virtuoso, David Garrett. His CD is David Garrett. David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
I had a wonderful time. Thank you very much for having me.